We're coming up at 7:59. You're listening to KPCW Park City on 91.7, 91.9, 88.1. And we have our first question. Hi, please step up. Tell us your name and your question.
I'm Maya Levine. I'm a junior at Park City High School this year. And I'd like to thank the panel for coming up and talking to all of us today. So when I think of fake news, I think of something that is said on the internet or online that you can easily search on Google to prove false. However, who is to say what is and what isn't fake news regarding, for instance, like climate change? There's two sides. You either believe in climate change or you don't. There are statistics for both sides to prove both sides' point. Both sides have a hard time believing the statistics of the other because of how strong an issue this is in current society. So regarding issues such as climate change or other important issues like climate change, who, especially in the roles of journalism, like who is to say which side is fake or not and how that plays out in society?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
Marcia, do you want to answer that one first?
I do think that it's a really good question because there is not 100% certainty on some of these very complicated issues. And so what we have is we have our best judgment. And in the opinion of our best judgment, which is the vast majority of climate scientists that have studied the issue, climate change is human caused, and it is caused by the burning of fossil fuels, and it is changing our climate in ways that are detrimental. So even though there is not 100% certainty on that issue, we just need to go with the best that we have.
Anyone else want to answer that, George?
I think this is where the grand traditions of journalism can come up and bite you, because we're trained as journalists to get both sides. And so we quote the 97% of climate scientists that say, you know, we're certain it's real, we're this close to certain that it's human caused, and even if it isn't, you know, it might be a good idea not to burn so much fossil fuel. You know, even if we're a little bit wrong, you know, what do we lose? Air pollution. So we ought to do it that way. We're trained as journalists to go find the other side and give balance, like bringing balance to the force. We know how that worked out. And sometimes, Edward R. Murrow said, sometimes there is only one side. And I know that, you know, especially, again, I go back to the community journalism, you know, whenever somebody would want a bond issue for a school or build a community center or something, you felt like, well, we have to find somebody who's against it just to be balanced. And most towns have somebody who makes their living being against stuff, and you can call them up and quote them, and that way, oh boy, my story's balanced. I've covered both sides, even though you know this guy's an idiot. And that's all he does is be against everything. And when you point out that he's living off my OSIDI payment on my paycheck, he's on disability, and he spends all his time talking about how the government wastes all his money, and he's living off it, well, you know, is it opinionated? Is it fake news to point out that the guy who's against spending taxpayers' money on teachers and community centers lives off the government? Or is that fair? Is that giving the reader the complete story? We got to the point where we just quit quoting this guy because it was ridiculous. It was obvious that he was just automatic parrot. He would just say, it's a bad idea, it's a bad idea, it's a bad idea. And so we quit. And after a while, some people would say, well, how come you don't have both sides? Well, if you want to be the other side, fine, but we're not quoting this guy anymore.
Go ahead, Marcia.
Yeah, that's another thing that comes into play in a lot of these issues, which is the old line, follow the money. A lot of times in some of these issues, if you follow the money, you can find out where people's motivations are. And in a lot of opposition to climate change research, if you follow the money, you will find out why people are opposed to the idea that that burning fossil fuels is hurting the environment. And that doesn't just only go with climate change, it goes with other issues as well.
Yes, Robert.
As we're sitting here talking about this, I kept thinking, is there no journalist rating system of any type? I would love to know. Like, you guys are talking like left, center, left, far right. Generally, I don't know that from my sources. I form my own opinion, but I would love to know, hey, this reporter, his scorecard looks like this. You know, he's far right, but the actual parent organization's like center right. And I have to know what that means behind that. And following what you just said, you know, what's the agenda of the organization producing information? Like, you know, Salt Lake Tribune, I have no idea if there's some hidden agenda back there or something they believe in, what their objective is. Everybody has an objective. It'd be nice to get all that with the information as it comes, but that's not readily available. Like, I can't tell you if I get something from fake news right away, what was the agenda of that organization, and how does that shape my opinion when I read the text of that information? But I would love to see something along those lines.
Ben, you want a rating?
Well, we tend to leave that to you, the news consumer, to decide. I encourage people to take into account a number of different news sources and take into account.
Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. You can stream us live on kpcw.org and on the KPCW app. This evening you're tuned in and listening live to the Project for a Deeper Understanding Forum happening local. Thanks for tuning in.
Left, right, hard news, opinionated news, and they plot them on this axis. You can take a look at this. You can find these online. But then, well, what's the agenda of the person who drew the axis? And then you have to try and filter that out. So it's a lot of work, you know, to be an intelligent news consumer.
Stu, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I want to go back to that question. I think it's fascinating. It was a good question, but climate change is an exhaustive topic. And you there's a never-ending supply of differences of opinion. And journalists can go as deep as they can on both sides, but they can never get to everybody agreeing on one side or the other. So she categorized that as fake news. To me, that's a pure example of the definition, the use of the word has gone awry because of public discourse out there. That's just not being able to ever solve an issue. It doesn't have anything to do, I think, with a fake element to the reporting of it.
We have a question.
Hi, I'm Nancy Garbutt, longtime Park City resident. And this is a fairly complicated question, multiple parts, and some of it's been answered. But I started with, so what's the difference between fake news and large-scale disinformation campaigns? And how can we be on the lookout for disinformation campaigns? The next part of it is, so because each of us filters any event through our own beliefs and our own mental filters, everyone has different perspectives on any one thing, on any specific topic or event. So how do we know what to believe?
Good question. How do we identify a campaign of disinformation?
Yeah, let me just touch on the disinformation component of that. Normally, if you're putting disinformation out there, whether that's military deception or something like that, information operations, we would normally call that, you hope to be able to control the information they have access to do the fact-checking. So you think of, like, closed societies like North Korea, they're not going to go out and Google to figure out whether that's true or not. And that's what you try to do is, you know, if you go in from a, and again, military perspective, you get rid of their access to the Internet. So you take their connectivity out to the rest of the world. They can't fact check those stories. I mean, there's no media there. There's no newspapers there. They're all government controlled. So different disinformation in that regard or deception, that's what you want to do is you want to control all the sources they have access to be able to prove that story one way or the other.
Does anyone else want to answer? Well, yes, Mike. Oh, sorry, George. Did you want to come in?
You know, it's to the point now where, you know, I think people in my profession are going to have to look back at you and say, you know, you have to exercise some judgment. After all this time of us being the gatekeepers, because there was only one newspaper and three TV stations in most towns, and you would look at all of them and they were pretty much the same because they all kind of wanted to just be reliable and trustworthy, and they weren't going to go off too far one way or another because they would anger their readers, they would anger their advertisers, and they didn't want to be that. as the media breaks up into a whole lot of things and nobody's going to be the only show in town, then you have to find your niche. So especially in radio and the internet, where you have a lot of stations, each competing for your limited attention and for limited ad dollars, then there is a little bit more of an incentive, a market incentive, to be a little bit more outrageous and a little bit more outrageous and a little bit more outrageous, because it draws listeners and it draws clicks. And I think most people can take a look at this and say, you know, is this clickbait? Is this really outrageous for the sake of being outrageous? Or is what it's saying backed up by other news sources, mainstream news sources, which are sometimes wrong, but over time are much more likely to be trustworthy?
I noticed that there was some advice about if there's a headline in all caps or if it links to a .co, or there are some domains, Nancy, I think, that are identifiable as suspicious. We've got another question.
My name is Mike Andrews. The question I have revolves around Facebook and Twitter. And obviously, over the past week or so, there's been a very obvious disclosure of the use of both of those social medias by the Soviet Union. It has been suggested that Facebook and Twitter be viewed as public utilities and subject to strict regulation or some kind of regulation that they impose themselves before the government comes in and does it for them. I would love to hear the panel's reaction to Facebook and Twitter and social media, the control of social media, and the responsibility they have to us as citizens.
I'd love to start with John Mejia on that one.
That would be really, really tough. I mean, they are, they have the right to speak. They have the same First Amendment rights as any other corporation. And I mean, there are certain circumstances where government can impose limitations on speech, right? So there, you know, for the most part, if it's a public forum, government can never impose viewpoint-based restrictions. And this is setting aside the question of whether we can determine something is foreign or not. But to start coming down the line that media corporations, whose purpose is to share ideas or spread ideas, could be treated like a utility and regulated, that's kind of chilling to me. The government, they can very rarely regulate speech, getting back to that. There would have to be a very compelling government interest. And the tailoring on the restrictions would have to be very, very narrow. And with something like Facebook, I think that as a practical matter, I couldn't see that happening. I don't know what kind of narrow tailoring you might be able to achieve. But, you know, to me, we start getting into trouble. I mean, the First Amendment promotes a marketplace of ideas, right? And so even if they're Russian ideas, or if they're ideas by Americans that liked the Russian idea, from our perspective, the solution isn't for the government to step in and start picking winners and losers. It's to keep the marketplace open so that you can get the information in to dispel that disinformation. Hey, do you realize that, you know, Marco123 is actually a bot, or is actually a paid Russian troll? So, you know, not to say Facebook, you can't put Marco123 on prohibited from now that we found out, you know, he likes Russia or whatever. You can't put him on your site anymore. Well, that's a problem, right? The way that we see that being fixed is more information. He's, you know, before you listen to him too much, this is his agenda. And once you have the government start picking winners and losers, then you start to think, well, now who's driving this conversation? Who's thinking, who's the judge of whether Marco123 is from Russia or not, right? And so always, from our perspective, more information. And I know that creates a mountain of information, but it is our duty as citizens to try to be discerning, and not the role of the government to start picking which people can speak in public forums, which ideas are acceptable in public forums. You know, like George was saying, nobody thinks that anybody is capable of being completely objective. I mean, to me, that's a myth, right? What we need is people to be discerning, to have as much information, to not have the government picking and choosing who hears what and believes what. That's especially dangerous.
Yeah. And just real quick, I mean, I would never think that Facebook and Twitter should be public utilities. I do think they have to stand up to their responsibilities as being publishers. And that's not so much a legal thing as it is a social thing, and where you stand up and take responsibility. And you also can be held responsible for the things that other publishers can be held responsible for, which is basically, you know, libel and obscenity. Mm-hmm. And they have to get away from the idea that they have absolutely no responsibility and no duty for anything that goes on their website. And that's what they've been trying to tell the government until about the last 5 days.
Mm. We have a question.
Yeah, my name is Glenn Wright. I want to start this off with Bob. Is there a possibility of developing algorithms that could judge the truth and falsehood of articles, give ratings, screen, you know, and also at the same time determine how many bots are judging this, the favorability of this particular article online, and could we develop algorithms that will give the user some ideas of how reliable a piece of information is?
Yeah, so the answer to that, and it was mentioned earlier, Facebook does have algorithms that do exactly that. I mean, they look for things like the time of day it's posted, the language it's posted in, the location it came from, the regions the information's appearing in, to try to figure that out. But it's a sliding scale, and some of the on the commercial side in the intelligence collection environment, we do the same thing, try to discern the validity of a source before we actually get eyes on it, you know, human eyes on it. We try to determine that, and we do look for things like, you know, as crazy as this sounds, even though it's written in English, I can see the character set of their keyboard behind the scenes they were typing with, and the keyboard character set might be, you know, a Big Five, which is Russian, or, you know, GP2312, which is Chinese. So I look for things like that. Even though it's written in English, I know behind the scenes there's metadata you don't see that says, hey, the character set was this. So we'll look for things like that. But and those algorithms try to take that into consideration, but they're just constantly being tuned. And every time you do something like that, because there's enough motivation behind it, either for a cause or monetarily, they adjust theirs on the fly as well. So every time we pick up on something, you'll see them rapidly change and say, oh, hey, these guys have figured this out. Let's make a change, or let's change the way the botnet works. So it's very difficult, sliding scale.
But would it be reasonable for, say, Google, Facebook, those types of organizations to constantly be tweaking their evaluations and publishing it with each article? This is on a scale of 0 to 100 with 50 in the middle, this is far right or far left, and this is reliable because of not very many bots or predominantly bots. Is that possible, and you know, should we start asking those organizations to do those sorts of things?
Without human analysts, it's hard. I mean, everybody tries to game the system. So like a Google search, you game the Google search. Like there's ways I can do search engine optimization to get more hits inside a Google page rank, and people are always trying to figure out those algorithms to game that. So it would be, it's feasible. I mean, I think you can march that way, but it's difficult, and the problem's always shifting.
Hi, next question.
Mike McFadden, Park City. My question comes from my reading of Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money. And what concerns me, I think everybody has a right to an opinion, but we have right now large fortunes and foundations dumping huge amounts of money into campaigns. And I'm really concerned that we can't know where that money's coming from. I'd really like to know who's supporting what candidate, and I'd like to have that available. One would think that with all of the technical abilities that we have now, the internet, that these very vanilla names that they have for their foundations or for this organization, you know, we should be able to come up with the big movers behind this.
Which technically, John, am I right? We can. Can't you get online and find it, Ben?
Yeah, there are campaign disclosures that are made online. I mean, as far as when you start getting into dark money and you start getting into some of these political action committees, it does get a little tougher. And one of my co-workers at Fox 13, Max Roth, is just absolutely brilliant with being able to, and he turns some of these stories about following money and where it goes from. And there are resources that you, as a consumer who's interested in this, can. You can go to elections.utah.gov, and you can look up who donates, because campaigns have to file quarterly reports. Now, if you see something that you're not entirely sure who that is or who runs them, sometimes a cursory Google search, putting in their name, can yield some results, can yield a website. You can kind of figure out for yourself what it means. You know, sometimes it does get a little even more trickier than that when you start getting into some of these aspects of, well, this is affiliated with this and that. But there are some publicly available things, and we do try to keep an eye on that as well when we report on who's contributing to what campaign, as a way of shedding light on, you know, where they may potentially vote or where they stand on an issue.
But I thought that if the foundation was largely non-political, and nobody really measures that, that they don't have to disclose sources.
John, do you know?
Well, I mean, without a specific hypothetical, I mean, I think that, you know, free association rights, if you are truly a nonprofit, I think that there's, you know, you should be able to, if people don't want to, funders don't necessarily want to be known, you know, I think that there can be anonymity there. But, I mean, I understand your underlying concerns, and, I mean, it's a multifaceted problem for sure.
I mean, that's one of the things they're trying to ask Facebook to do, which is all the ads, and then, because, you know, you see a TV commercial, and, you know, paid for by somebody. I'm Gary Herbert, and I approve this ad. It's a way of trying to, even if you don't regulate what they say, at least providing the voter with some transparency. Where did it come from? And so now with Facebook and Twitter, they're saying, well, you ought to say where this came from. And Twitter says, well, it's 140 characters. We can't say where it came from. Well, you could put a link. You could do that. And that's one of the things that they're going to be talking about in Washington, like, next week, is, you know, what to make Facebook do in terms of disclosure. But it also, I think, comes down to the fact that, yeah, I mean, if somebody is buying, you've got a lot of dark money pouring a lot of campaign ads into saying, I think we ought to drill in Escalante, to some degree, it doesn't matter where the money comes from. Either that's a good idea or a bad idea, and we should be able to judge it on whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. And if a ton of money comes from some nefarious fossil fuel company someplace, tough. You can still make a determination as to whether you think where the oil wells ought to be drilled.
Next question.
Bob Lux, Park City resident. I'd like to talk a little bit and get some of your ideas on what we can do about it. You know, this is dangerous. Fake news, in the context of when we all grew up, most of us, many, many years ago, we trusted literally everything we read, saw, or heard. The question is, with fake news being whatever it is, omission, filtering, distortion, coding of facts, and let's say that facts can be proven at some point to be absolute and real. We're not talking philosophy here. The question really is, should we be teaching our kids to question everything they hear, see, and read? We don't teach civics anymore. Kids don't even know how many branches of government there are. But I think this is more dangerous, because now, instead of parents, these kids have their phones and their laptops and their buddies on Twitter. They're just taking it for whatever it is. And the question is, how do we make them aware of the fact that their minds are being controlled by, not by their own thinking, but by these dangerous sources?
So media literacy. Do we teach it? How do we teach it? Marcia.
One of the things that I came across was a study by Stanford University where they showed different news sites to middle schoolers, high schoolers, and college students. And it was interesting that these students, even at the college level, were not able to distinguish between what we call advertorial and a regular news story. So even though it was marked sponsored content, they really didn't understand what that meant. And other things that came out from the study was that even college students didn't quite understand what advocacy journalism was. So news-ish stories that were coming from advocacy groups. Now, whether those are true or factual, they might be, but they are coming from a point of view. So I do agree that there are media literacy concepts that could be taught to students, and that's something that I try to do in my work at the university. And instead of just telling the students, don't go to any source but the university library, we talk a little bit about what you find out on the internet and what are the different types of materials that you can find and where do they come from and how can you evaluate them, even if it's just as simple as going to the About Us page of a website and looking to see who are their staff and where are they coming from. So I think that's something that we could really work on. Even as parents or grandparents, you could do that.
Yeah, media literacy is fundamental. As I say, the people who wrote the First Amendment were trusting us to evaluate all this stuff. They had no concept of a single news source or a single government that said, okay, here's the facts, and there's no other alternative. The oldest continuing published newspaper in the United States is the New York Post, which was founded by Alexander Hamilton for one purpose and one purpose only, and that was to libel Thomas Jefferson. That's why it's there. It's still there because it makes just enough money to keep going. The people who wrote the First Amendment were up to their neck in lies, and they knew it, and they understood that's how it worked, and they trusted the people to find their way through it.
Hello. Next question.
Hi. I'm Angela Mosqueda. This is my first project for Deeper Understanding Forum, and I have to say this is a really impressive panel and a fascinating discussion, so I look forward to more of these. My question has to do with the intersection of money and the choices that you talked about. I think sometimes the advantage is that we are in this little microcosm here in Park City, and sometimes it's a real disadvantage. And I think something true of Park City and true of everywhere is that most people are not like the panel, where you are turning to multiple news sources and looking for multiple points of view every day. Everybody tends to rely on the largest news sources wherever they live. And here we have two. We have KPCW and we have the Park Record. I think most people still, you know, tune in and listen to the radio. A lot of us actually walk our dogs with headphones on, listening live. The Park Record has become digitized, and the majority of people encountering their news on the Park Record are going to the website. So when you talk about money, in order to drive advertising dollars and lure people, the money there, everybody turns to clickbait headlines. And I think it's become a real problem with our local paper. So my question, I think to kind of take the previous question one step further, isn't just how do we educate ourselves and our children, but how do we stand up and hold our media to a higher standard, force our journalists to be more ethical, to step away from clickbait, become more neutral, and let people make up their minds where they will?
Stu, I'd love for you to answer that one.
Yeah, that's another really interesting question. I think that we should all pledge here tonight to not be gullible. Unfortunately, I think people go to places where they want to see what they believe in. They don't want to see alternative opinions, so they are in a Facebook group, they go to a certain website. And the real danger there is that you need to seek out both sources. My daughter is a real young, very liberal woman, and she routinely quotes a conservative talk show to me, what they said today. I go, what the heck are you doing? And she goes, I need to see both sides of that. And I think it's real dangerous that if you see a certain slant on a story and it's from your network and you read the headline and it supports everything you believe in, if that's the total amount of your research and that's all the time you want to put into it, that's very dangerous and very scary to me.
Ben, address Angela's point, though, about local news sources relying on sensational headlines for clickbait. I mean, in the television news world, we were always accused of saying things like, how your sock drawer will kill you, film at 11.
Why your next trip to the salad bar could be your last tonight at 10. Yeah, I mean, it happens. And this is a battle we face internally, because people say, oh, I want vegetables, and I want the meat and potatoes of news. But when you follow their actual habits, they want candy every time. They want to know what the Kardashians are up to. You know, you say you want this, but then when you go here, and it is, we're driven by ratings. We people tune in. We have metrics that tell us what people tune in. That allows us to sell advertising. That allows us to pay our bills to keep broadcasting. It's a cycle. It's the same thing with newspapers. They have to sell subscriptions. They have to sell advertising that allows them to reach the subscribers. So it really is, we get accused of that. We try to provide a balance, a mix of things. We try to show you the things that we think are important that you need to hear. And then we try to show you the things that we also think that you want to hear. And a lot of this is also just being a consumer, someone. I would encourage you to tune into a local TV newscast to see different perspectives. I would encourage you to read papers, you know, around the region, too, to see how things are viewed, and is a way of doing that. Also, you know, in terms of the aspects of how, you know, we try to give everything, and I'm not saying we're perfect. You know, we could do better, but it is important that you let people know, though. If you don't like a story, I mean, call us up. I mean, call the person up in charge, you know, the news director or the editor, and say, you know, I think you guys can cover this better. I think you can do more.
Yeah, John.
And on some occasions, the clickbait actually can be something that is meat and potatoes. Like, I think of the story of the nurse at the University of Utah that went worldwide fast. But that story does tell us, you know, it gives us some insights into some important issues and, you know, has generated, I think, questions and follow-up stories that are important about how, you know, police procedure, policies, you know, what were they doing there? Why do those officers or did that officer think that he could act like that, and how can we change it? So, you know, I think high interest doesn't necessarily mean that it's a meaningless story, but I agree, sometimes it's definitely sugar.
Just about 4 or 5 months ago, we installed 3 very large television screens in the middle of the Salt Lake Tribune newsroom. One of them is, most of the day it's on CNN, kind of at night they put maybe football games on it or something. Mm-hmm. The middle is the main page of our website as it is right this second. And the third one is our chart beat feedback thing that shows us second by second what are the most clicked on or referred from Facebook, Twitter stories right now. And the nurse story was number one on that hit parade for weeks, because everybody came to us, and it got picked up by Facebook, and it got referred, and it was in the BBC, and it was in the New York Times, and to their credit, they linked to us, so we got a lot of that traffic. And you know, it's mesmerizing. You go over there, and the screen in the newsroom only goes down about 10 stories. It goes hundreds if you scroll down. But, I mean, that is very useful information. We know what's being clicked on. We know what's being shared. We know what's being retweeted. I think we should know that. I don't think we should live and die by it, and I don't think we are, but, boy, that thing, that's right in the newsroom. We're looking at that all the time. And sometimes it's just something as simple as just rewriting the headline. I mean, you're not necessarily making it more sensational. Maybe you're making it more accurate or more descriptive, or putting in words like Utah or something that will draw people to take a look at it. So it is a responsibility. I mean, with great power comes great responsibility, and our responsibility is to watch this and try and do the right thing. Your responsibility is to call us on it. I mean, we put the bridge column back in the paper after taking it out. I mean, somebody got really upset about that, and we changed.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Ricky Case, and my question relates to journalistic standards. I heard a statement early on in the panel discussion saying that as journalists you hold yourselves to an ethical standard, which made me wonder what exactly is that ethical standard and how do you learn it? And is it universal from one country to another? And is it written down anywhere? And who holds journalists accountable to that standard?
I'll answer that one.
Yep.
There's two great organizations, Society for Professional Journalists, spj.org, and I keep their ethics and standards in a nice little fold-out in my desk. There's also RTNDA, which is Radio, Television, Digital News Association. They have a whole standard of ethics as well, and we would have those posted in the newsroom. It's a great list, and it's one that I think every journalist should subscribe to, and in fact, I brought the SPJ Ethics Committee position papers on political involvement with me tonight in case we needed to refer to that. I was actually going to bring it up in light of the 96% of journalists contributing to political campaigns, and I think what journalist would contribute to a political campaign? No journalist I ever worked with, I mean, we had a very strict policy about you do not do anything that gives an appearance of a conflict of interest when you're a practicing journalist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't sign petitions. I don't contribute to political campaigns, and I'm try to be very careful about what nonprofit organizations I give to, just in case I end up covering them later. If there's a conflict, you declare it and talk to the newsroom and or talk to your bosses and see if there's any kind of a problem or challenge there. I do vote because I do believe that is another fundamental right as a citizen, but I know journalists that I've made friends with in other countries, Pakistan, Germany, places like that, they don't, because they believe that they want to be truly, purely neutral.
And George, I'm guessing the Tribune has a pretty strict ethics policy.
Yes, it does. And it's a little more flexible when it comes to opinion writers, because we're supposed to have opinions and we can stand by our opinions. And, for example, the other day I was approached to sign the petition to get the redistricting thing on the ballot, and I signed it. If I was a news reporter who wasn't supposed to have an opinion, who covered these issues, I would have not have signed it, regardless of whether I felt it was a good idea or a bad idea. I don't make political contributions. Of course, you know, it's kind of an excuse. Somebody asked me for money, and I say, oh, well, I'm very sorry. I'm a journalist. I'm not allowed to give you any money. So that's a useful dodge. I do vote. But like I say, I'm an opinion writer, so I have a little bit more flexibility. The reporters are expected not to participate, not to have yard signs, not to make political contributions, not even if they don't cover that government or that race. And we did have somebody who was on our web staff who did not cover things. He wrote headlines and made sure things got posted online and kept that up. And he was bothered by the fact that he couldn't participate in street demonstrations and do that kind of thing. So he quit. And he went to work for an IT company that didn't care what his political opinions were, and he's much happier. And I was kind of sorry to see him go. He was good at his job, but that was kind of the choice he had to make.
And just really quickly, I did print out the Society for Professional Journalists standard, and it's in the back of the room if anyone wants to pick it up.
There you go. Great. Thank you for that, Marcia. Next question.
Hello, panel. My name is Dave Cushing. I live in Park City. And this is pretty much for our expert on the botosphere. What's your name?
Bob.
Hi, Bob. I'm Dave. What are the chances that a bot is running on my phone or any of my computing devices right now? Number two, how do I know? And three, what can I do to stop those bots?
The chances are really good. I mean, if you've seen any of the Snowden information or the leaks or look up Shadow Broker, I mean, it's everything from your phone to your TV, if your TV is internet capable. So the devices are endless. As long as it can talk to the internet, it can be compromised. How do you tell that? Most people don't have security software on their phone. So I hate to say on the phone it's going to be tough. I mean, I do. I'm an oddball that way because that's what I do for a living. But most people don't. You can actually buy security applications for your phone. So you think of like your home computer or your laptop or whatever. You'll have traditional antivirus or some type of firewall software on there. That should catch most of that. On the phone, just most people don't deploy that on the phone as much. And it's really the onus is on you because your service provider, so, you know, Xfinity, Comcast, whoever, they don't care. They really don't care unless for some reason it affects your billing, like you're downloading 10 times more than you should or you're uploading 10 times more than you should. They're not watching for that. And I say that because I work with those folks as clients and understand what their concerns are. But you know, the onus is really on you to, you know, deploy some type of security software to detect those conditions.
Will the built-in Windows or Apple security suites by default block bot action?
The newer Windows components will, Bitdefender and such, they're actually pretty good. As a Mac user, I hate to say this. I mean, Mac really doesn't have that built into the operating system like Windows does. Not as much targets a Mac. It's just a fact of life, just because there's not as many out there, right? So if you want a huge botnet, you don't normally go after Macs because there's just not as many of them. But natively, Macs don't have that capability built in like a Windows machine would. And I say that as a Mac user, so.
Could I ask one more question? Do we have time?
Are you okay if you ask one more question? We'll make sure there's time.
This question about demographics. I'm in a strange demographic. I don't use Facebook. I don't use Twitter. And I stay off of all Google products if I can. It's kind of hard. But what are the demographics of people that are susceptible to fake news?
Anybody?
I will take a whack at this. And it goes back to the question Glenn asked earlier about, you know, tuning the algorithms. You realize part of the algorithms are us, right? So when you're on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or whatever, if you go and read the story, that ups your count. That shares that with your trusted friends or users on that forum that you're in. So you're part of the factor of how things get put out there. So if, you know, it's almost like groupthink, right? If I read it, and it's going to assume, hey, all my friends on Facebook would also be interested in that, and now they're going to see that thing, and if they read it, it just keeps going like that. So that it goes back to that algorithm of, like, how do you stop it? Well, that's one way, is not to read them. But it's kind of like a train. It's like a train wreck, right? I mean, I'm on Facebook, and I see them, like, that's ridiculous. I got to read it. You know, it becomes, it's the sugar, it's the candy at that point. And then when I do that, I know all my friends that come and look at my stuff, they're now all seeing it, and I'm like, why is Bob looking at this? Because it probably has some link to me somewhere. And they're like, why is Bob reading this stuff? What's good entertainment?
So we have our friends to blame for what we're seeing?
You absolutely do.
Might unfriend some people tonight. Okay, we've got a next question.
I'm Ray Freer, and I live in Park City. And I wonder how much influence the ownership of these various media groups influences what is said. And, the Murdoch family owns Fox, and the Huntsman family, or Paul Huntsman, owns the Trib. How does that influence you, or does it at all?
I'd like to answer this one. I know I'm supposed to be the moderator, but this is a hot button for me. You've heard of Sinclair Broadcasting. And Sinclair is recent. It owns Channel 2 in Salt Lake. It's about to own Fox 13. And they are owned by David Smith. He's the CEO. But they demand that the TV stations they own air editorials. And as a news viewer, they have a fellow named Boris, the fellow who used to work for the Trump, Epstein, who does terrorism alerts. Is he the guy who does terrorism alerts? For someone who wanted to answer the question, I'm botching it big time. But there are some media organizations out there that do dictate news content. For many years, I was the news director at Fox 13, owned by Rupert Murdoch, went to budget meetings with Rupert Murdoch. Not once did Rupert Murdoch ever tell us what we needed to air on Fox 13. I'm sure he was telling Fox News Channel what they needed to air, but not once did he ever tell us in Salt Lake City. I guess maybe we weren't on his radar. But and Roger Ailes didn't either. So I was very appreciative for the bandwidth they gave us. I mean, total, they didn't tell us anything. But it is becoming more of a problem thanks to the deregulation in the FCC. So it's something that I think people need to be more and more mindful of, who owns this media entity
and what is their political agenda? Now I'm going to open up to the panel. Thank you for your allowing me to answer that. Stu, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I'm owned by a very large company. We're the largest owner of stations in the country. I've worked for them for 15 years, and there hasn't been one single day where they've ever steered us either editorially or any other way. We do subscribe to National Music Research, and we use some of their advice on that. When the Dixie Chicks did their thing in London and bashed George Bush, we were accused of pulling Dixie Chicks records off country radio stations as a corporate directive, and it wasn't true at all. If you play a Dixie Chick record and large amounts of your audience call you and say, stop that, I don't like that song or those people, you become influenced by what the local people say, but we were never influenced by our company to change our playlist because of that event.
George, you want to talk about Huntsman and the Tribune?
Well, yeah. I mean, for a while there, we were owned by this outfit called Alden Global Capital. And the good and the bad thing about Alden Global Capital was that they didn't give a damn about what was in our paper. And they also didn't give a damn about whether our paper had enough resources to survive. And there's a new, I wish I could find it. You might just be able to Google it. There's a new article out there about the owners of Alden Global Capital and what they're doing to the newspapers they still own, not out of any political agenda, just by starving them because they don't want to spend any money. And what they are is flip artists. They buy property. They buy distressed properties like newspapers, and they hope and they bleed them so that they're not costing a lot of money, and then they hope to sell it to somebody else. In our case, we were fortunate enough to be picked up by Paul Huntsman, the Huntsman family. He kind of drops once in a while that we are the smallest thing he's ever bought. So he doesn't really lord that over us, but and he is publisher. He's the owner. He gets to decide who the publisher is. He decided himself would be the publisher, which is not uncommon. And as publisher, he sits on the editorial board, and so he has a great deal of influence over what the editorial stands, endorsements, things like that will be. To the best of my understanding, he has very little to say about what the news stories are, because he is a businessman, and he knows that if you, as Warren Buffett says, if you don't know jewelry, get to know the jeweler, and he trusts us to run a newspaper, because that's why he bought it. He thinks, you know, this is a pretty good newspaper. It ought to survive, and I don't know how to run a newspaper, so I'm not going to tell him how to run it, and he doesn't. There was a lot of awkwardness when the Huntsman family got into a fight with the University of Utah over their cancer institute, and you know, on the editorial page, we had our say. On the news pages, I would stand by what they wrote, what they covered, as accurately reflecting what was going on.
Just quickly, it seems to me the Mormon Church is quite transparent. We own the Deseret News, and we dictate the content of that Deseret News. Would you agree with that?
Well, as a reader from the outside, I think that's pretty clear. They had a story this morning, I think it was this morning, about the issue about the cake baker in Colorado, and he doesn't want to do this. And there was like 40 inches of why the cake baker was right on the front page, you know, and followed through and all the reasons why the cake baker is right. Maybe there'll be another story tomorrow about why the cake baker is wrong. I kind of doubt it. And one thing that, you know, it's not necessarily an LDS thing. It's kind of a cultural thing. Several years ago, they were going to do this thing that in Salt Lake City that they do in other towns where everybody's supposed to read the same book, and we all talk about it. And Rocky Anderson was mayor, and he or whoever was working for him picked this book, The Curious Case of the Dog at Midnight, about an autistic teenager in Great Britain who doesn't want to be treated that way. Anyway, This is lower middle class Britain, and they say words that I'm not going to use here, like some people say, well, and it's that often. And if you're going to accurately portray lower middle class Britain, you're going to have that word in every paragraph. Somebody at the Deseret News went through and counted the number of times that word appears in that book. I mean, 13-year-olds do that. That's and giggle about it. To me, that was a bad news article that was influenced by a social agenda that didn't make any sense at all. Although, when I nominated myself to write the editorial that defended the book, my editorial page editor did the right thing. He said, you have to read it first. So I did, and I recommend it. It's a wonderful book.
Next question.
Okay, so I was very interested in coming tonight, and I've been thrilled to have these fantastic panel members that you brought here for us to listen to, and all the discourse has been great, too. But I haven't had one question answered. What does fake news have to do with the demise of civil discourse?
Thank you. That's the title of our forum, isn't it? Who would like to answer that? John.
I wouldn't have selected that title. I guess to the extent that fake news spreads largely because people have retreated into their own bubbles. Perhaps, you know, the civil discourse, I think to me, would imply that both sides are talking to each other and trying to work it out. And when you have an environment in which people are unwilling to listen or believe somebody who doesn't agree with them, that seems like it would be a good environment in which disinformation can spread because people want to hear what they want to believe.
But Robert, can't these bots stir the pot? Isn't that how fake news affects civil discourse? It gets us mad at each other?
It definitely does, and it's emotionally driven, and that's where the civil part of discourse ends, right? Anything that's emotionally charged or driven, by definition, there is no civil discourse left. So, as John mentioned, when you surround yourself with that, or that's your only source, or your only source of information, or all you tend to read on Facebook or whatever, you've just ignored civil discourse at that point.
And Stu, you talked earlier about that person who's angry and they're pounding the dashboard and they're listening to the radio station. Does that help or hurt civil discourse, do you think?
I think it actually helps because we do get a chance to stir it up. I think that I was fascinated on, I think it was 60 Minutes a little while ago, Oprah had members of both sides of the political spectrum discussing, then arguing with each other. And I think the biggest thing that's missing is that we can go to, say, social media, we can send a text message, send an email. It's not really conversation. When we sit down, we could disagree on something here tonight. If we look each other in the eye and talk about it, it just takes the understanding of each other's position up a notch. So I think social media, people are hiding behind that computer. They're sending out one-way messaging, and they don't want to defend their position or really have a conversation or hear something from somebody else with an opposing point of view.
And real quick, as a follow-up, Marcia, you study rhetoric and communication. Are you seeing more angry discourse happening as a result of fake news?
I'm having a hard time answering that question. I think I see people do love righteous anger. It energizes them. Sometimes when I would give my students materials that were written maybe from a neutral point of view, they didn't like them as much. They would say, I want to read things that make me angry. And I think sometimes that can be a good thing. If you are well informed and that anger gets you up out of your seat to go do something that is based on your convictions, then it can be a good thing. But if it is just becomes a way of confirming that your side is good, the other side is bad, and there's no real productive result of it, then it's not a good thing. And the other thing, too, that I think with fake news is that I kind of view it as information pollution. And there I'm talking about the type of fake news that's just bogus. And so I do think that type of fake news does contribute to the demise of civil discourse because it misinforms people. So it's not just so much that people have their convictions that is causing a problem. It's just that if people are misinformed.
Robert.
I think people just tend to like calls to action, as you just said. I mean, nobody stands up and says, go neutral. You know, I mean, one way or the other, you want a call to action. It makes people feel good. I'm sure there's people who like to read something that's fair and balanced and form their own opinion and get that viewpoint. But I think everybody wants to take some type of action, wants to be a part of a movement one way or the other. So that call to actions, it's never going to be neutral, unfortunately.
Thank you for that question. Next question.
Hi, my name is Linda George. Thanks, all of you, for being here.
I'm not sure. My question is maybe not strictly fake news, but more different outlets choosing what aspects of maybe accurate news to present, and also the blurring between news and entertainment that's happened. But it seems to me that I've noticed, especially over the last several months, it seems like maybe subsets of our country have different views of reality, and they've evolved over maybe 8 or 10 or more years to the point where I'm never going to convince my brother, who has different political views, of my beliefs, and mine are very entrenched, kind of like the climate change or global warming. And I just wonder, like, if we have these silos, do you see anything, a trajectory or anything the media might, I don't even know what to ask, but I thought I'd put it out there for comments. Thanks.
Stu, how can big media, mass media, unite and get us out of our silos?
I think anything that we can do to incite conversation, I go back to what I just said a few minutes ago. The thing I like about talk radio, for example, is the fact that people can call in. It's not one-way communication, it's two-way communication. I just think that's critically important. And, you know, here's a key issue that I think is present today. I read a survey a little while ago, our research study, and it said that human beings now, on average, have an eight-second attention span. A goldfish, by the way, is 9 seconds. So part of that means that we might glance at a headline and a sentence or two and feel like we're informed. That's the scariest thing of all to me. We've got so much input coming into us, and I don't know what we can do to really change that, other than telling people to just dig a little deeper in what you're looking for.
Yeah, Ben.
A couple of really easy things that I think that people could do, and I do see this a lot, is look beyond the headline, click the article, read the article, and then comment. But also, subscribe to different viewpoints. You may read a story on the same subject, but read it from different perspectives or different outlets. You may see some of the similar facts. You may see something, and it is about choice, what the journalist puts in, chooses to put in. A detail here that maybe this news outlet had a detail here from, or an interview from somebody that this news outlet didn't. But it all goes to help form, give you more information. That's what we're trying to do, is give you information so that you can make that choice, whether it is a rallying cry of, you know, support this, or you know, get behind this, or whether you're like, no, I oppose this, and I want to let people know why I oppose this. But getting your news from different sources helps you to become more informed so that you can make that choice of what you believe or what you stand on that particular issue.
We've got less than 4 minutes left, so go ahead real quick.
This should be quick. First of all, you are the defense of our liberties. And so I thank you for what you do, and I don't think you're well rewarded all the time. But having said that, what always astounds me is we'll all get a certain set of facts, and then we can diverge totally in terms of how we perceive those facts. And I don't know whether you have anything at all to say about that, but it just astounds me that the left and the right can get the same information, and then we can separate from that.
Marsha, how can someone see a police shooting and say it's the cop's fault, and the next person say it's the victim's fault?
I heard a really interesting podcast about that, where a woman and her friend, who was a cop, looked at the same police shooting video, for hours, and they could not come to the same conclusion. One was a cop, one was a journalist. And I think in those situations, it's where a lot of times each person gets a little bit of what they want. So when I study public debates, for example, with vaccinations, sometimes with other issues, each side gets a little bit of what they want. So that's where our liberty comes into play. And so we all have our liberty kind of to make our choices, and that's I believe in that.
Two minutes left. Go ahead. Last question.
A couple things. 501c4s are a nonprofit that are social welfare, and the Supreme Court decided that they don't have to disclose who they are. And they pump a lot of money into the news media during political campaigns, and they hide behind the shield that the Supreme Court did to them. And I found that to be a very disheartening problem that we have as a society, that they're treated differently than any other responsible organization. Google has started doing news feeds that are kind of like bots, and I happened to click on a couple things for crayfish, and all of a sudden, my world is now revolving around crayfish. And somebody else will click on a story for George Bush or Donald Trump or something, and that news feed will aggregate that stuff and then steer their opinions to where they think they are. And it's not a bot in a sense of what the military may have or what we are fighting, but it's news aggregation based upon our clicks, be it Facebook or anything else. And that's what's creating a lot of the discourse, because I'll read the same article as, say, Ray, and we'll get different opinions because of what we clicked on before at Google or somewhere else. And that's really dividing a lot of the discourse when I have conversations with other people. And it's really, I'm finding a lot of discord with that.